Shrink Wrap Radio number 435, The Potential of Video Games to Fend Off Mental Decline, with journalist Clive Thompson.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with noted journalist and return guest Clive Thompson about his recent article, Can Video Games Fend Off Mental Decline?, which appeared in the October 23, 2014 issue of the New York Times Magazine. Clive Thompson is a longtime contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and a columnist for Wired. For more information about Clive Thompson, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Clive Thompson, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Good to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on the show again. It's hard to believe that it's been nearly a year since our interview about your book, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. And I have to say, my brain is still buzzing from that interview. So once again, welcome back.
I'm really glad you enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun too.
Yeah, I really did. I put you on my list of the best of Shrink Wrap Radio, and since we're in the this will be number 435, so that's saying something.
Excellent.
So today we're going to be discussing an article that you wrote for the New York Times Magazine titled "Can Video Games Fend Off Mental Decline?" And needless to say, as a somewhat senior person myself, I have a real personal investment in this topic. You're a lot younger than I am, though, so I'm curious, what drew you to investigate this subject?
Well, I had actually paid attention to this question kind of, I guess, in the periphery of my attention for a long time. I mean, I'm a video game player from way back. I'm 45, so I am really the first generation of kids that sort of played video games their whole lives. I was perhaps 10 years old or maybe 9 years old when Pong first came across my ambit, you know.
Yeah.
And then pretty soon I was playing Space Invaders and Pac-Man and the big explosion, you know. So I was a late kid, an early preteen when they came along. And what that meant is two things. One is that I really enjoyed playing video games, and I have my whole life. The second thing is that I grew up with a concern, you know, sometimes expressed soberly and sometimes expressed hysterically, that video games would irreparably deform my brain and my moral fiber in various ways, right? It goes back as early as you know, you remember Ronald Reagan sort of praising video games by saying that they would train the fighter pilots of the future. And this is, of course, you know, a big issue back during the Cold War, right?
Yeah. Now we have drone pilots.
Yeah, drone pilots, exactly. I mean, it turns out he was so right in a crazy way that he could never have known. Because it turns out that the skills for flying drones are really assisted by playing a lot of video games. So anyway, I'd grown up with this concern and this issue, and I'd been spending all throughout the '90s and the aughts reading as much as I could on the way video games affect your perceptual apparatus, the way you think, your habits, and whatnot. And two things leapt out. One is that the concern, the earliest concern was really, would they make us into violent little sociopaths, right? And that seems to have not really borne out. I mean, outside of the fantastic data we have on the rapidly declining amount of youth violence, the exact people that are playing the video games, just whatever tests they've been able to do as best they can, it seems to have really no effect on aggressiveness or whatnot, except in a small minority of kids who already wrestle with aggression and impulse control. For them, it's actually, video games can be bad. For the vast majority of kids, not a problem at all. So the violence thing has been, I wouldn't say it's settled, it's never really settled, but you know, for now that seems to be the answer. But what started happening, and this is really interesting, you know, once I sort of got past the initial are video games turning us violent concern? A lot of scientists started getting interested in, well, okay, are there any potentially constructive or useful side effects of playing these games? And a lot of these academics were people who themselves had actually grown up playing games. So they were in their late 20s and early 30s in the 90s and aughts when they started investigating this stuff. And so this really got me interested because I thought, well, you know, I wonder if there are any, you know, potentially positive effects. And so one of the things that they started looking at things like the ability to train your attention, to sort of to move from stimulus to stimulus, which is something that adults tend to be, as we get older, we tend to get really bad at. It's called speed of processing. And it's our ability to sort of, you know, go from one, focusing one thing to focusing on another thing and going back and forth and reacting quickly when someone says something, you know, or someone comes up to you and talks to you, absorbing it and internalizing it and then coming up with a response. This is all speed of processing. It really gets worse in adults for a bunch of reasons. There are many things about the aging brain that get better, but this is the one that gets worse. And so they noticed that young people seem to get really sharp on their speed of processing the more they played video games. They actually got better at deploying their attention, ignoring sort of irrelevant stimulus. That's another thing that the aging brain is bad at. We're bad not just at shifting our attention quickly, but we're bad at ignoring irrelevant stimulus. We get distracted more easily.
That resembles me.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, and I can already feel it myself, right? So these game people were doing these tests on younger people and going, well, it seems like they get a little bit sharper on these skills they're already sharp at. So they started wondering, well, maybe this is something that would actually have a palliative effect in older people too. If we had them play games, maybe they would improve in these eroding skills. So this is how I got interested in this. Now, what happened with the New York Times, actually, as it turns out, called me out of the blue. I'm a contributing writer for them, and they were planning an issue devoted to aging, specifically, you know, how to counteract aging. Mm-hmm. And they called me and said, well, would you want to write a story about these brain training games? Are they any good? And I said, well, I'd love to look at that because I've been studying it. And I'll tell you, though, it's kind of funny. It's a funny story. So when they first called me and said, you want to write about brain training games? Now, that immediately brought to mind the sort of the panoply of you know, sort of things you see on the web or apps you see on the phone saying this is, you know, based on brain science, it'll keep your brain sharp. And I'd known from having read neuroscientific op-ed articles and a little bit of research that there was a lot of very overinflated claims made about these games. That most of the times they were made by, I don't know, someone just making a fun little memory concentration game, you know, and claiming that it had this scientific effect, but having absolutely zero evidence. So my first response to my editor was, I said, well, you know, I'd be happy to write about this, but my sense is that most of the stuff on the market is snake oil, you know, and I said, so I'm not sure I'm going to find anything for you. But I wanted to keep an open mind to see what was out there. I had looked in the periphery of my mind at this research, but I hadn't burrowed down deep into it. So I spent, you know, some weeks reading everything I could and talking to dozens of different scientists who'd done work on this. And the conclusion I came to is actually that the field indeed was of games specifically aimed at aging people. There are a lot of them out there. Most of them have not been tested in any way at all. But there are some glimmerings here and there that this stuff could be useful, done in moderation and as part of an overall attempt to keep your body and your mind sharp. Some of the most interesting studies had to do with looking at these very longitudinal effects where they had old folks play games and then followed them for 10 years and discovered, oh my goodness, there were some very positive, very small but very positive effects. In other cases, there are some very, very robust and well-designed modern studies coming along where they're saying, okay, let's not just guess at this stuff. Let's do really, really carefully, rigorously controlled science. And they're finding a couple of positive effects here and there. So I ended up in my story base, he's saying, you know, this is still a very new field. It is still a very gestational field, and there's mostly ignorance. We mostly don't know what's going on, and there are certainly, you know, you have to approach almost all these games that are out there on your phone or whatnot with caution, because they very, very there's very little research into them. But it struck me that there was a maturing of the field. People were trying to. Scientists are trying to look at this more carefully. A few people who were designing the games were trying to design them more carefully, and there were also a couple of companies that were trying to go for actual FDA approval for their games, which is really interesting, because then they actually have to prove that this device, you know, has some sort of an effect. So they're actually trying to say, you know, we're not just going to claim that this game improves the aging brain. We're gonna prove it to the level of standard of evidence of the FDA, so that it can be prescribed as a medical device.
I would think that would be the holy grail for these companies if they get that approval.
Well, yes, because of course at that point in time they can bill for it, right? I mean, or a doctor could prescribe a game and it would have a billing code, so an insurer could pay for it, right?
Yeah.
At that point in time, so there are obvious market reasons for companies to try to get serious about proving their claims, because if they really can do it, it could be enormously lucrative, right? You know, it's sort of a win-win. You know,
yeah.
if they can make a game that really works and prove it really works, that's good for us who are trying to keep our brains sharp, and good for them, because, you know, suddenly, you know, if Aetna or whatnot will actually pay for this thing, then the market, you know, grows by a lot bigger, basically. So it's interesting. Basically, I concluded it's very interesting times, still early times, but maturing, and people are trying to be a little more serious about looking at this area. It's very interesting.
Yeah. You point out that it's already a $1.3 billion a year industry, and as you point out, a source of controversy. Now, in your article, you talk about your visit to a San Francisco lab where they're developing a game called Evo that some neuroscientists think might have positive potential. Maybe you can take us through that experience that you had when you visited that lab.
Yeah, sure. So basically, this game is a really interesting one, because it was created by a scientist named Adam Kazaniga. And he runs neuroscience.
I'm looking at your article. Was the name Ghazali by any chance?
Oh, sorry, Ghazali. My apologies. I'm completely mispronouncing it. Ghazali. Adam Ghazali. I apologize. Gazzaley.
Great.
And so he runs a neuroscience lab at the University of California, and his lab is really interesting, because, I mean, it's a traditional neuroscience lab, but he has a special competency in trying to think about this question of whether games could keep brains sharp. And so one of the reasons why his work has been received very well is that he has tried very hard both to run experiments that test for whether or not there is a measurable improvement in skill. So you have to sort of test people's reactions and measure that stuff. Secondarily, he wants to see whether or not you can observe in brain function, when you sort of peer into the brain with brain scanning, whether or not, you know, there's actual changes happening that are detectable at the brain function level, because then that gets more interesting. Then you can say, well, not only are we seeing an apparent improvement, but we're seeing a brain change, because there's a lot of reasons why someone's behavior could seem to get better without their brain actually improving. Like, you know, you could maybe there's these things known well known effects in science called the Hawthorne effect, where if you change someone, the way someone does something, and observe them, they sort of feel excited by participating in the experiment, and they get better temporarily at what they're doing, because the whole situation is kind of new and fresh.
Yeah.
But after a while, when it stops being new and fresh, the improvement goes away. And this is a major problem for a lot of experiments. You know, you you give a bunch of kids iPads in their grade four class, and you know, lo and behold, for the next 6 months they work harder and they do a little better on tests and they write longer things. But that's because it's sort of exciting and new to go to school. They've got these iPads. A year later, the iPads are no longer new and their improvement sort of goes away. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to not only see if he can spy an improvement in people's cognitive performance after they play this game, but he wants to see whether or not he can correlate it to actual changes you can observe in the brain. And this is I think he's being very meticulous about it, and this is why many neuroscientists who are really skeptical about this field were actually, they all said to me this, okay, this work strikes us as good. So what's it like walking into the lab? Well, his lab is really funny because in one sense it looks like a normal lab. You've got a couple of great big huge, you know, fMRI tubes for sticking your head in for scanning it. Those, you know, the MRI tubes. He's got like a room filled with all the apparatus for, you know, EEG skull caps where you stick on your head and it records electrical activity. But he's also got like this thing that, you know, that looks basically like a great big, you know, awesome basement or man cave where he's got this like an 80-inch massive TV for playing video games and a comfy chair and a lovely carpeting. It really looks nicely designed. And it's because he really wants to study what happens to people's minds when they play games, kind of in the way that they would play them at home, you know, like just on a nice big old, you know, sitting in your den with your big old flat screen. So it's a very fun place. And I got a chance to play this game, Project Evo, that he made, and it's an interesting game because so the way that his experiment that was released a year ago, or is it reported a year ago in Nature, what he did was he created a little game and he got a couple of former video game makers to actually try and make it a good game. So, you know, because frankly, a lot of scientists, they'll try and design a game and it's just not fun to play. I mean, they don't know what they're doing. You know, it is scientifically sound, but it is not. It's not very addictive.
Artistically, it falls short.
Precisely. Aesthetically and artistically and culturally, you know. It hits the mark scientifically and falls short culturally. He wanted a game where the people would be excited to play it, and they would not want, you know, him to take it away from them, like the excitement of playing a real game. So we got a couple of these guys from LucasArts, people who used to make games, you know, Star Wars games, you know, real serious game makers. And what the game was designed to do, this original game he made called NeuroRacer, and we're talking 5 years ago. The goal, his theory was, if you could get the mind doing a couple of different tasks at once, it would create a sort of a productive interference that would overall improve one's cognitive function. Because he was trying to avoid the problem of what's called the problem of transfer, is interesting. It means that you could do a game that would make you really good at one thing, but it would not transfer to other parts of your life, and it would not transfer to other parts of your brain. So I could play a memory game on my phone. You know, typical, you know, here's 50 cards, you know, try and find pairs, you know. Classic concentration game. If I played that for a few months, I would probably get really good at that game. But it would not necessarily mean, and we've found this in studies over and over again, it doesn't necessarily transfer to your everyday memory, right? I mean, I get good at that game, but I only get better at playing that game. It doesn't help me remember where my keys went. It doesn't help me remember, you know, appointments. It doesn't help me remember things, you know, facts of that I read in the newspaper. And it also doesn't improve other aspects of my thinking. Like, you know, it's not going to improve that speed of processing, the ability to move back and forth. So what Ghazali thought was, well, if I can get people doing a game that requires two or three difficult mental activities at the same time, you will overall improve the brain. And so the way the game worked is you sit, and I played his old game from 5 years ago, NeuroRacer. You sit down, you put one of these skull caps on your head, that an EEG thing that measures the electrical activity. And you're driving a car, and it's going down this winding path, and you're trying to simultaneously keep at a steady speed, that you're not supposed to go too fast or too slow. You have to stay in this range. And you're trying to not drive it off the road. You've got a bunch of spatial abilities being tested there, right? But at the same time, you're doing a very lightweight version of what's called a Stroop test. These are very classic sort of mental processing tests. They show you, you have to recognize when something is a certain color, a certain shape, and they'll try and fake you out. Like they'll say, you know, hit the button when you see the red square, and they'll show you red squares, then they'll show you a black square, then they'll show you a red dot. And you go, and your brain goes, oh, red, 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 I better hit the button. But it's not a red square. It's a red dot. They're trying to fake you out with color, or they'll fake you out with a shape. They'll show you a blue square. And you're like, oh, it's a square. I should hit it. No, it's not a red square. A Stroop test is a standard sort of test of, you know, your ability to pay attention to a couple things at once. You have to pay attention. You know, I'm looking for not just a square, but a red square. So you're sort of doing this little Stroop test as you're driving the car down the road. And so there's a bunch of stuff going on. Like I've been playing games 45 years. It's a challenging thing to do. And it's also adapting. This game is also adapting to your performance. So if you're kind of bad at it, it slows the car down and makes the less windy path and gives you, it slows down the Stroop test. So everything, it's calibrating itself to you with the goal that as you get better, it gets better too. And it calibrates itself like every 3 minutes. So I played that. And it was difficult. And what he did was he gave it to a several dozen people in their 60s and 70s and had them play it for a month. And it was really interesting because at the end of the month, obviously they were better at playing the game. But again, that's the transfer question. You know, like, are you better at playing the game? Are you better at life? Well, it turned out, you know, they were in fact better at a bunch of standardized tests for mental ability, and that was pretty cool. And they were also better at some tested abilities that had nothing to do with the actual game. So it seemed as though it had reached this fantastic transfer rate. It had improved, you know, the basic spatial stuff, you know, attention switching, but a bunch of other, like working memory, got a little better. And that's really interesting. Working memory is your ability to hold a couple of tasks in mind at the same time. Like I'm shopping and I've got a bunch of things in my memory. So it seemed like there was transfer, and that's really cool. And the third thing, and this is really interesting, was that when he actually looked at the patterns of the brain activity of the older people, after a month, when you started off, the patterns of a 20-year-old and a 6-year-old look really different. And he tested 20-year-olds and he tested 6-year-olds. But at the end of the month, the 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds that had played this game had mental activity scanned out of their brains with these EEG caps that looked very similar to the 20-year-olds and no longer looked anything like the other 6- or 7-year-olds that had not played the game. Yeah. So like not only could you see an improvement in a wide array of skills, which is great, but the actual brain activity started to look a lot younger. And so there was just a lot. He really dotted his I's and crossed his T's this day. It's super interesting stuff. And
what about subjective reports from people?
Yeah. That's a really good point. I asked him about that, and he said, well, you know, many of them said that they felt a little sharper. But you always have to take subjective reports with a grain of salt because, again, you have the problem of that Hawthorne effect. You know, the fact that they've been playing a game, you know, they know something's going on with their brain, and so they're liable to just say, yes, I feel sharper. And here's the other thing. I'll give you the flip side of that too. I actually visited. I went out to the house of Anne, one of the women who was in his study. I guess she's in her 60s. And I asked her that. I said, you know, like you played this game for a month. She's like, yes. And, you know, she had a lot of fun. She enjoyed it. She got good at it. Kind of cracked her up because she'd never played games before. You know, her grandchildren used to laugh at her, not even about video games. So she got good at the game, and I said, well, you know, did you notice anything in your everyday life getting better? And she sort of said, not really. Like she felt in an abstract way that maybe she was sharper and better at switching from task to task. But real practically, you know, had it improved her everyday life? Not in any way she could detect. And to me, I found that really interesting because, you know, it indicates that, you know, you can, you know, effects that you can test for and you can see an improvement in the lab don't necessarily net out in everyday life. And so this is why, you know, I like to say this, you know, all the science that looked at this said, well, this is interesting stuff, but, you know, really what we need to do is find some real world stuff. And there are hints of that in other research. You know, there are definitely hints of potentially powerful real world effects. But in this case, yes, there were some self reports, but nothing you could really hang your hat on.
I seem to recall in your article, was she the one that had developed various tricks to help her remember things like taking her pills and?
Oh yeah, sure.
And you notice that there's a whole industry of sort of external helpers.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah, see, you know, as we get older, we get bad at remembering things. And one of the things we particularly get bad at is what's known as prospective memory. So, memory, you can loosely divide memory into a couple of different types of memory. There is there's autobiographical memory. There's, you know, my ability to remember things I did. I went to Paris in 2000. There is semantic memory. That's my ability to remember that Paris is a city. That the Eiffel Tower is a thing in, you know, a sort of factual memory separate from my autobiographical life. They're related, but and then there's this third thing that is prospective memory, and that is my ability to remember to do something in the future. And it turns out that this is the one that really gets us in trouble, right? If you do studies and ask people, so, you know, what type of memory failures really plague you? You know, they'll all complain about, you know, spacing out on a name or a phone number or a fact. And those are annoying, tip of the tongue, you know, problems.
Yeah.
But the one that really causes damage to our everyday life and hurts our performance at work and everything is prospective memory. Planning to do something and then spacing out on doing it. And so with old people, this is often a medical issue. You don't take the medicine at the right time, doesn't have the impact. And this, and not just old people, I mean, even, you know, you're in your 20s and you get you've got an infection and you're supposed to take a regimen of 3 antibiotics every 8 hours and you don't do it and you remain sick for longer, right? So prospective memory failures are really a big deal. The funny thing about old people is that they are really, really good at learning, hacking interesting ways to externalize their prospective memory so that their environment does the remembering and the reminding for them. And this is people have noticed this for decades, that like old people are really good at, as their prospective memory fades, they're really good at figuring out, okay, so here, what technique can I do to remind me? And so, you know, that ranges from just leaving the pill box in the center of the kitchen table. So every time you walk in the room, you see it. And so you're going to be triggered many, many times a day to think about that. And then, of course, there's just this whole, you know, regimen of pill boxes with multiple, like, you know, 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 2 o'clock. And then, you know, putting Post-it notes all over the place. I've read studies about these really amazing things, and there's a lot of technologies that are coming along too. Like they're making, you know, pill boxes that basically know how often you've opened it, and if you haven't opened it today, they start making a noise. And if you don't pay attention to the noise and don't open it, they send a tech message to you or to your loved one. I heard about these. I'm going to get one of these. I know the guy that created this company. I met him 10 years ago. And I followed his career, and it's really interesting. And this pillbox is really an interesting thing. They did a little corporate study of it, and it appears to have some effect. So Anne, the woman who I visited, who was in the study, in fact, she, you know, one of the things that had alarmed her a little bit about her mental state was she said she had found herself forgetting things, like she would forget her purse in the car, She thought that was, you know, that was bad. So, you know, the game didn't necessarily improve her mind to the point where that problem went away. But she did find a classic sort of way to externalize and outsource the task into the environment, which is that she bought a much bigger, you know, more colorful purse. Because, as she points out, if you've got a little tiny purse, it's easy to leave that anywhere. But if you've got a great big one, it's harder to leave it behind. You know when you've got it in your arms and when you don't. And so this is a classic, brilliant technique that aging people often hit upon.
For me, my version of that is I buy covers for my iPhone and my iPad in outlandishly loud colors.
Yes!
I'm not going to forget and leave it in a taxi cab or something.
Well, what I do for prospective memory, so I'm a very heavy user of Google Calendar. I used to only like paper calendars. I hated digital calendars. And I only moved reluctantly about 5 or 6 years ago away. But here is what tipped me. It's because you can set up, I can set up my Google Calendar to send me a bunch of alerts in advance of everything. So I've set it that 24 hours before it emails me saying, hey, you're doing this tomorrow. And then it texts me like, it texts me 1 hour before to say, hey, you're doing this in an hour. And then it texts me 5 minutes before to say, you're doing this in 5 minutes. And I swear to God, this has saved my bacon. I work in Brooklyn. And occasionally people, a scientist, a business person, an artist will come through Manhattan and I'll make a lunch date to go and talk to them in Manhattan. And it takes about an hour to get from where I am to get in the subway, head into Manhattan, be in Manhattan. So I can't tell you the amount of times where I've looked at my calendar in the morning and, oh, I have a 1 o'clock meeting. And then I space out on it. I forget about it. I get absorbed in my work. And then at noon, 1 hour before, I get a text message from Google Calendar saying, oh, yeah, in 1 hour, you're having lunch. And if that reminder did not come along, I would have just blown right past it, and this poor person would have completely annoyed them. So I do that, but I do something. This works in concert though, because I still find it possible to ignore those alerts. I still occasionally will not look at my calendar or will ignore something. And so the other thing I do is if there's something really urgent that I have to do before I leave the house or on the way out of the house, I get out a big thick Sharpie and I just write a note, 5 words on a piece of 8.5 by 11 duct tape. Duct tape it to the front door, and my whole family they like this now. My kids are like, when they'll be like, Dad, remember to do this tomorrow, and I go, I will. And they're going, put it on the door, you know, because they know that and it really works incredibly well. The other nice thing about that is that the whole family becomes aware of the memory issue, right? You know, it's now a social piece of memory because I'm saying, okay, you know, buy the latest Percy Jackson book at Barnes & Noble today. Well, if I put that on the door for myself, well, the kids and my wife and everyone sees it, and so that makes the memory a communal memory that we're all trying to remember to do. And this turns out to also be an incredibly valuable mechanism because Daniel Wegener is this wonderful researcher, psychologist, and he started noticing back in the, I guess, the 70s and 80s. I mean, he wasn't the first one to notice it, but he was the first one to name it. The fact that people who are in intimate relations, husbands, wives, friends, colleagues and children and their parents, people who are in intimate relations share the task of remembering things. I'm really good at remembering the details of when taxes are due and some financial stuff. My wife is really good at remembering stuff related to vacations, to school stuff. And so I know she's good at that, so I don't bother remembering those things. So we are one joint brain remembering these things.
Yeah.
A family works that way. This is another really interesting clue to some of the problems we have with aging, which is that older couples, if they've been together for a long time, you and your spouse, you and your partner have an extremely well-honed set of things you rely on each other for in this what's called transactive memory. And if someone dies, suddenly that chunk of memory leaves.
Wow, and I never thought about that.
And so we knew long before Daniel Wegener pointed this out, we knew that there was this feeling of being cognitively bereft that happens when a partner dies in your 60s or 70s, even in your 30s and 40s, frankly, but more deaths happen, obviously, older. People would describe that it felt like a part of their brain was missing. And in a very real sense, it was. They realized that their ability to access parts of the past, parts of their daily routine, parts of plans and names are gone because they were part of a system that was larger than their own mind, and that mind is now gone. And this is a really interesting problem. I often say, people, my mother is, she's 80 now, so she lives at home. But she's looked into potential homes to move into if she detects her memory problems becoming an issue. And I've talked, here's the funny thing though, is that you know, when you get older, often two things happen to you. One is that, you know, maybe you lose a partner. And the second thing is you often move out of, if you have enough memory issues, you move out of home and into a different residence. And those are both catastrophic for your everyday memory functioning. Because when you lose a partner, suddenly half your transactive memory is gone. And when you leave your house, all the systems that you had set up to help externalize your memory mm-hmm. are gone too, because you're now in a new environment. And this is why you often see these catastrophic plummet downwards when someone is doubly bereaved and then moves out of their home. It's because our mind, and this is funny, this goes back to my book actually, because my book is about how technology, you know, affects the way we think and how often it's for the better. We like to think of our minds as being these, you know, just floating in a jar and they're completely, you know, self-contained. But it's not really true. A huge amount of our thinking is very embedded in the people and the objects and the environment around us. And if you change those people, if you change that environment or change those objects, you can remove a lot of the scaffolds that allow us to think in rich and think and remember in rich and deep ways. So this story about started off with video games wound up getting very deep into this question of the way of the ways that that not just aging brains but all brains think and remember.
Yeah, you know, one interesting note is that as I was reading your story about Anne preparing for this interview, it reminded me to take my pills, my morning pills that I'd forgotten to take.
Yeah. No, I'm in the middle of doing a regimen. I developed two incredibly painful plantar warts on my feet. And,
oh, my God.
And, you know, you would think, because they're painful every time you step, that you'd remember to take the medication for it. But no, I space out on it twice a day. I'm supposed to do it every 12 hours, and I blow past one. And, you know, there you go. So it is very interesting thinking about what systems could help us maintain better functioning. But of course you see, by the way, the utility of transactive memory in this regard, because if your partner knows the medication has to be taken and is on top of it, they become an additional system helping you stay on track. If they're not there, if you're alone, or if they're incapacitated and they can't monitor that, you know, everything gets a little trickier, and you have to think of other coping devices.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about let's move on and talk about Lumosity and also Posit Science and
sure.
Brain HQ, both of which I've had experience with, and love to hear your stories around those.
Sure. So now these are the two, I guess, if you were to think about brain training games, the ones people know about. These are the two big ones in the field. There's Lumosity and there's Brain HQ by Posit Science. And they both have different orientations related to the science. With Lumosity, you've got a company that was started about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, maybe a little longer, by a young guy who was taking a neuroscience degree, neuropsychology, but got so interested in this idea of games as improving your thinking capability and your intelligence that he sort of just stopped working on the thing and started this company. He did hire a bunch of other people, you know, who think scientifically about this, and they set about to try and create a bunch of games that in their view would improve your mental sharpness. You know, there's a concentration game, like a memory game. There's speed of processing tests, you know, trying to react to something. There are games related to their Stroop tests, those things where, you know, they'll show you a word, they'll mm-hmm. show you the word blue written in yellow and say, what color?
Yes.
You know, exactly, that type of thing. Now, there is not, you know, by their own admission. I mean, now, Lumosity is interesting because, like, on the one hand, when you talk to them, they're actually, I think, reasonably candid and humble about what's known and what isn't known about their games. They will tell you that there is not a huge amount of science studying Lumosity. There are many there's really only a handful of papers that have been published that have any sort of finding at all. And you know, there's a file drawer problem here, which is that you hear about somebody has a study that comes up with a positive finding, they publish it. Somebody comes up with a study that has a negative finding where there was no result for the games, they might not publish that, right? You know? And so, you know, you never know what stuff you're not seeing. So there's really only 7 or 8 papers that, you know, you could get your hands on that say there's anything happening with Lumosity. There are another several dozen in the works, but that's all there is right now. So when I'm in the room talking to them, they're actually quite candid about this. In their marketing materials, there are a little more a little more assertive of the
sounding
and the stuff, right? And so you have this sort of schism where the marketing side is basically, hey, it's all science, it's scientifically proven. You know, if you actually talk, you're like, well, you know, it's there is some science, and you know, there it's provisional, you know, whatnot. So I think this is a classic marketing problem where the sort of science, you know, you find this in almost any, you know, pill company or whatever, where, you know, things get overblown, you know, when a time comes to sell the thing. So I think, you know, those games are fun to play. You know, I've played them. Do they actually improve your thinking? No one knows, right? The Posit science is a little different because it is actually founded by a very prominent neuroscientist, Michael Mazurnich. He is a guy who, back in the 70s and 80s, is really one of the absolutely pioneering foundational thinkers about neuroplasticity, which is the idea that the aging brain changes and adapts all the time. It's not frozen solid. There used to be the idea that you grew up and your brain changed when you were young, and then it sort of congealed like plaster, and that was it for the rest of your life. And Mazurnich was one of the pioneering people that said, no, that's not true, and I'm going to prove it. And he did. And he decided that because, you know, the brain could change all through its aging period, that he wanted to see if he could modify it and make it better. And so he started looking at games, and he started developing games, and he acquired games that looked like they had some promise. One of the games that he incorporated into Brain HQ is one that actually does have some of the most solid science that's out there. Carlene Bell, a psychologist, created this very simple little rudimentary game in the 90s that sort of tests your what they call the useful field of vision. I think I'm getting that right. Or useful field of view. It's either useful field of view or useful field of vision. And basically, you know, think about it as your ability to look in front of you and how wide an area do you sort of notice, right?
Yeah.
And what happens to older people is that shrinks. They get more tunnel vision, basically. And this is a problem for a bunch of things. It makes it harder to drive. You're not noticing things in the periphery of your attention. It even makes it trickier. You're just walking down the street. You're paying attention to what's right in front of you, but not seeing things coming to the sides. You get more collisions. You get more – that's where falling and collisions, all sorts of things come from. So if you could improve this field of view, that would be a really good thing. And so she, you know, created this little game that basically stresses and tests and encourages you to try and get a wider view. And there have actually been, by the way, this is one of the things they've discovered in young kids playing video games, that even just playing like Call of Duty, where you're just running around and shooting stuff, it seems to improve their field of vision, their useful field of view, because they're having to sort of monitor this environment, this very chaotic environment. So Carlene Ball back in the 90s has this game, and it gets incorporated into one of the most genuinely longitudinal studies of cognitive training ever, the ACTIVE study, it's called. And what they did, it's quite astonishing. This is along with Ghazali's work, this is the other piece of research that even the very skeptical neuroscientists who think that this whole area is just overblown marketing hoopla, even they say, yeah, the active study is quite powerful. So Carlene Ball had this little game, and it was used in the active study. So back in like 99, 2000, 98, this study took thousands of older folks and had them train, do three different types of cognitive training. One of them was given some basic memory techniques, like how to memorize lists of groceries by sort of visualizing them, you know, using these classic visualization techniques. Another one was given processing speed, sort of speed of processing stuff. Another one was given they were given Carlene Ball's useful field of vision, field of view. Game to play, and they didn't play it a whole lot. We're talking about maybe a couple of dozen hours over 10 hours over a short period of time, and then two and a half years, or think of like about a year and a half, and 4 years later, a couple more hours of top up. Right, so they didn't play this a whole lot. Yet, when they followed up with these people 10 years later, they found that the people who had played the useful field of vision, field of view game, were a little better at tests of that ability than people who hadn't played it. And like everyone had gotten worse because they were now 10 years older. They're in their 70s and 80s. But the people who played that game were had declined less than the other people, noticeably less. But this is a really interesting thing. Professor Ball went and got their driving records, you know, with their permission. And it turned out the people that had played that game, even for this very small amount of time, had dramatically less incidences of accidents caused by them being at fault, right?
Wow.
50% less accidents caused by them. And of course, this is what you would predict if you thought people's field of vision remained superior, was that they would collide less. And this is such a real significant finding. It's not a little finding. It's a big one. And for that to happen with such a small amount, as another neuroscientist said to me, that's like doing a bunch of push-ups for half an hour in 1999 and finding it keeps you stronger 10 years later. You know, I mean, it's really interesting. And it begs a question, as I talked to Dr. Ball and I talked to Michael Mazurnich about this, because that intellectual property is now part of BrainHQ. You know, what would the dosage be like to make it even better? Like, could you play this a certain amount every day? So Mazurnich has done a lot of probably more than any other company out there. He has participated in more scientists have used the BrainHQ Post-it Science study software than pretty much anyone else. Like, there are on his website, he lists over 70 papers that have used it. That's a bit of an exaggeration. It refers frequently to the same data set. Like, the active study is referred to many, many, many times. So it's not quite 70, but it's definitely more than Lumosity or more than anyone else. So there's definitely more science to be had with BrainHQ. It's still not terribly rock solid. I mean, you know, as much as I think Mazurnich is a terrific scientist, the company itself, you know, does its own, I think probably, you know, overblows on the marketing side its own findings a little bit too much. Like, this stuff is still, you know, this stuff is still not as well, anywhere near as well understood as one would imagine.
Yeah.
But there's not nothing. There's some sort of a signal to be pursued and looked at here.
Yeah. And several things are in my mind right now. One is, with all the games that you've played and games like Call of Duty and so on, I would think that inadvertently they have many of these same elements. And so,
And so
it'll be interesting to see at some point, I don't know if anybody's done this research yet, but to look at people like you who've been playing games all their lives and to see what kinds of, does that slow down the cognitive loss or not?
Yep. Exactly. There's been a couple good meta studies that tried to look at everything we could find about games and cognition, and some of them actually looked at studies that were just of, you know, exactly what you're talking about, like a regular game, not one that was designed for scientific purpose. And they have found, you know, small effects here and there. You know, they often related to things like this question of speed of processing and the field of vision. It seems that, like, yeah, you know, my having played, I mean, I went up and bought Dragon Age, you know, the other day, which is a new game I'm playing on my PS3, and I haven't cracked it open yet, but it's your classic sort of running around, you know, engaging in sort of knight-errant battles and magic and stuff like that. And I can tell you, when you're in the middle of one of these games, I mean, they are, you know, there are downsides to playing video games. They're very addictive, man. You can blow off your work and wind up homeless, you know, wearing your underwear in your parents' basement. I'm the first one to admit that I've struggled with how fun they are. But, you know, but definitely when you are in the middle of it, they're cognitively demanding environments. You're trying to, like a lot of these games now, you have to remember an overall task you're doing. I'm trying to defeat this, you know, I'm trying to get to the end of this quest, and there's all these sub things you have to remember. Like, I have to, like, I'm trying to manage my abilities. Like, if I'm going to fight this particular monster, what type of ability should I deploy? I've got 20 different abilities. you know, so there's all this mental stuff on top of what you – like if you were to look at the screen, you'd see someone you'd be hacking away at a dragon. But there's all these other mental tasks going on that I'm trying to balance, and often I'm having to monitor a very complicated informational environment because a lot of these games now – in the old days, you know, you played Space Invaders. All you had to look at was, you know, a bunch of missiles coming at you. Now there's like – there'll be like what they call the heads up display that shows me, you know, what's my power meter, what's my enemy's power meter, what is my magic power meter, do I have enough magic stored up to be able to deliver a knockout blow, there's the map, like where am I oriented in the battlefield. It really is, it's this astonishingly information rich environment that that is, when you're in the middle of it, it's fun, it's delightful, it's got that sense that Michele Csikszentmihalyi talks about flow, where even though it's hard, it's joyful because you're pushing yourself to the limits of your abilities. So, you know, so having experienced that and enjoying it so much that I go back to it voluntarily, you know, I certainly find it plausible that there is something useful to be had out of this. I think that the question with keeping your brain sharp in games is it's also, you know, it's this question of, you know, how do they fit into – what are you doing with the rest of your life? I mean, like, all the neuroscience – there was a very strong statement against brain training games and brain training games hype that came out recently from the Stanford Center on Longevity. And they basically – I talked to their head scientist there, and she said, you know, the problem is that we can't tell people that, you know – only playing a game is going to be good, is going to be sufficient for keeping their brain sharp if they, for example, have a terrible diet, if, for example, they don't get any exercise, if they have no social contact, if they don't do any reading, and if they don't do any skill acquisition. One of the things that appears to work really nicely for keeping your brain nimble as you get older is constantly acquiring and deploying new skills, like I'm going to learn how to do a new language. I'm going to learn how to do this particular art form. I'm going to learn this thing. That there's something about that really seems to have a salutary effect on a mental function. So even though the games, you know, might be incredibly delightful, they have to be put in the you have to sort of do it as part of an overall program for keeping your body and your social life sharp, because as we have now learned, these are all embedded in one another.
Yeah, now speaking of the body, going back to Ghazali, you mentioned kind of in passing that he was working on a body-brain trainer. What's the status of that?
Very cool game. I got a chance to look at it. So basically the way it works is it's a game that runs on the TV. So I walked in the room and there was this, you know, 70-inch, 80-inch TV. And it's hooked up to an Xbox. Now an Xbox has this thing – has this controller that's called the Kinect controller. And really what it is, it's just a camera that looks out at your body, scans how you're holding your body, and uses that to control things on the screen. So you could use it to sort of virtually bowl or virtually, you know, if you jump around, the character on the screen jumps around. So he created a game that basically it does that same thing where it gives you a couple of tasks to do simultaneously that are hard. So you are on the screen, you see someone riding a horse, you know, away from you. You are the person on the horse. You're controlling the horse. And as it rides along, it has to jump over objects and lunge out of the way of obstacles. And so you're having to sort of move your body around and do these big jumping maneuvers whenever you see an obstacle to make it jump. Yeah. But at the same time, there is one of these classic Stroop tests happening up top where you have to lunge over to one side or up or down when you see a target object. And I think it was something very funny. One was like a radish, you know, and there was like a carrot, and you had to sort of get the radish and not the carrot. Things that look similar but a little different. So classic test. So you're simultaneously paying attention to the horse and trying to control the horse or jumps over obstacles, but you're also trying to do this thing. And that and like if you want to get the radish off left, you have to sort of lunge out far to the left. So you know, I watched a young, you know, probably in her late 20s, woman play this game, and you're wearing a heart monitor too, so it actually monitors your heart rate. And after barely a minute or two of this, she was like up at like 140, you know, heart rate, and all this mental stuff going on. And what Ghazali wants to test is whether or not there is an additional benefit to your brain to doing this very embodied form of cognition, to doing a thinking task that requires you to react to stimuli with your body as well as your mind. And as he points out, this is something that, you know, really only, you know, high-end athletes have to think about. Like, you know, where you're having, they're having to use their body in a very precise way to react to sort of patterns and whatnot. And, his hypothesis that this could be good, but, you know, it'll take him a few years to test it. It looks like it looked like a gas. I mean, the game
looked like
a lot of
fun.
And the funny thing is, of course, you know, this is again, you know, related to things that are out there on the market. Because, you know, beginning, I guess, almost 10 years ago, there was the Dance Dance Revolution phenomenon, where there was this you could buy this sort of 3x3 grid of pads that would sit on your living room floor, and you had to dance on the pad, putting your foot down on different pads in a sort of a dance pattern, in sync with the music and a grid that's on the screen. And I play this game. It's really hard. And you would be just exhausted at the end of it. And there were all these people that did Dance Dance Revolution diets, where they would play it for like 2 hours a day, and they lost like 30 pounds.
Wow.
And crucially, not limiting their calories, just burning more calories. Because, of course, you know, exercise is boring and dull, but this is fun and it's a game. And so, once again, you know, we can use these things. This is what Jane McGonigal, the game theorist, calls positive psychology. The one thing that's really useful about video games is that they work on positive psychology. Rather than trying to say, don't do this because it's bad for you, it encourages us to do something that's good for us by making it fun. And this is the promise of games that could actually get us using our bodies like that, is that they could harness the positive psychology of game design to say, yeah, you know, don't just dance around for 10 minutes, do that for 2 hours, you know, and really get your heart rate up there. And it's just funny. It's just making me think that I need to go out and get one of the Dance Dance Revolution pads for my family, because I'll bet my kids would find this hilarious. And I am too sedentary. I mean, I am a journalist. I sit in a desk all day long. I need to move my butt.
Which platform is that on, by the way?
You could get it for anything. You could get Dance Dance Revolution for a Nintendo system, for a Sony PlayStation system, for an Xbox system. They sell them pretty much. It's an old enough game that you can get them pretty much anywhere. In fact, you could probably buy about a 7 or 8 year old PlayStation that's $30 now, the PlayStation 1, and find an old version of it for like $3, and the pads for $15 on Craigslist, and have the whole thing set up. That's one of the nice things about it. It doesn't require a high end expensive system. It'll work on anything. Those are fun games.
Now, something that you touch on and that we should mention is the kind of cognitive fatigue that can set in and create some resistance to staying with these games that are, quote, good for us.
That's right. Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, like, there's a couple problems, there's a couple dangers with games, or I guess limits of games as a palliative, is that on the one hand, you know, they can be very sort of, they can be very addictive and they can be a lot of fun. But there's also a thing that everyone who actually plays games, and I've certainly noticed it, will tell you, is that there's kind of a curve of interest. You get very gripped by something, but then, you know, after you've sort of played it for a little while, you feel like you've sort of sampled all there is to experience with it, and you drift away. And in one sense, for regular video games, this is good because it prevents you from constantly playing the game and never doing anything else. There's this moment when finally you're like, you know what? I think I'm done. Like, I've actually played this game enough. I understand all of its complicated aspects. I understand all of its dimensions. I don't need to play it anymore. And for people like me who can be a little compulsive about games, that's a delightful moment. It's the moment when the game releases you from its talons and you can go wash the dishes and pay attention to your children. But this, of course, is a problem for creating a game that is going to be good for us, that we should play regularly, is that the typical way that irony their gamer plays a game is you find something fun, you get very addicted to it, you go kind of crazy, and then you sort of drift away, you know, for reasons that are organic or whatnot. That's not how you want people to do something healthy for them. You want to do it a little bit every day. You don't want them ever to get so addicted that they're doing it to the exclusion of other things. You want them to do it for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes a day, 20 minutes a day, and to do it for 15 years. And no one's designed a game that's like that. Most people have made games that are designed to get you very addicted and then keep you in for as long as they can, but knowing that you'll eventually stop doing it, right? And so
I was going to ask you, in fact, with your exposure to these brain training games, are you currently continuing with any of those, or are you?
No, I'm not. The closest one, I mean, I tried Brain HQ and I tried Lumosity, and I found them kind of engaging. You know, definitely they're well made, but yeah, you know, at some point in time, I kind of just drifted away. That's a problem. Yeah.
One of the things that happened for me with Lumosity, and I'm not sure if this is true of Brain HQ as well, was you always have to start back at the beginning. I wanted to have some sense of progressing, and it gets a little boring to always start from zero and work your way up.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like they need some way of designing something so that there is a little bit of novelty along the way that makes it feel like we're exploring new ground. And that strikes me as an important design element. I think you've hit on something that is puzzling to the people who make these games, and in and I'll tell you, there are people inside the world of games. Like they don't make games for serious purposes. They don't make games for medical purposes. They just make video games. And they'll say, man, give up on the idea of making a game that has any secondary purpose, because it's so hard for us. They'll tell you, like, all we're trying to do is make a game that people will get addicted to and pay money and play obsessively for 1 month before casting it aside. And we have trouble even doing that, right? Like, making a game in and of itself is so extraordinarily aesthetically and technically and culturally difficult that making it also serve another master, which is to say a healthy purpose, a salutary purpose, is really you're jumping over two very, very high hurdles. Or I suppose you're taking a high hurdle and making it even higher, if that metaphor makes sense.
I wonder if you saw that coincidentally there's an article in last week's New Yorker magazine about the X Games and how these video games are now being taken seriously, and there are major tournaments, and they write about a young woman by the name of Scarlett who's, you know, made hundreds of thousands of dollars and has had to go to South Korea where the really champion gamers are. Have you seen that article?
I've seen it. I have not read it.
It's
sitting in my New Yorker pile, and I've been following this rise of professional gaming, sports gaming, and basic games as spectacles that we watch, even if we're not playing them ourselves. We find them interesting to watch, and it's a, you know, at its best, really good games are not only engaging to play, but they are so strategically interesting that it is fun to watch a master do it. In the same way that it's fun to play basketball, and it's really fun to watch people that are absolutely fantastic at it play. And I've definitely experienced this. I mean, for all of the sort of – this is one of the things I think that was ill understood in the early days of games, in the 80s and 90s. There was this idea that they would isolate you because you were staring at the screen all the time. But the truth is, the games were and have always been extremely social. You would go over to your friend's house and you would watch them play, and you would talk about their play, and you would hand the controller back and forth. You would argue about strategy. And even now I see, you know, with my kids, you know, they who are 7 and 9, and their friends are that they all play Minecraft, and they will sometimes they'll invite a friend over, or they'll go over to a friend's house when someone's playing a game, and they'll just sit there chattering and talking about it for like an hour and a half. You know, like someone will be doing something, but they're just trading this blizzard of information and knowledge and thoughts about the way the game works. So a really good game inspires like a high level of as much cultural conversation as a good sport or a TV show or a book does. And that I think is what you're seeing when you look at the rise of these professional game players is that it's a very interesting maturation of the field. I mean, it's halfway between watching, you know, Kasparov take on another grandmaster in chess, and halfway between that and, you know, going and watching a baseball game or something like that. It's very interesting.
Yeah, well, I have a hunch that we're running up against your timeline. I know you've got lots of things on your taped list on your door, probably.
Yes.
So it's always such a blast talking to you, and so I really want to thank you for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed it too.
It's always such a rush to speak with Clive Thompson, in more ways than one. So much energy and information, a virtual fire hose of enthusiasm and great content. Clearly, his brain is working at top speed. I can't help wondering if that's a result of playing all those video games over the course of his whole life, starting at such a young age. I guess there's no way to know, since he did start so early. For a long time, there was a lot of fear out there about cancer. I'm not sure if that fear has abated or not, but I'm thinking it might have dropped down to the number two concern given the widespread fear of Alzheimer's. I also think that the world is waiting for a big breakthrough in terms of staving off or even reversing Alzheimer's. And at the same time, there's been a lot of advice to the effect that various kinds of mental stimulation, such as doing crossword puzzles or learning a new language, will slow the process down. I think we've had conflicting information about those sorts of claims. And given what we heard from this interview, the jury is still out in relation to video games, although Clive's research into the industry suggests that there are promising developments in the works. One of the promising quarters he mentioned is the Posit Science Brain HQ games developed by neuroscientist Michael Mrzenich. Synchronistically, about the time I was preparing for this interview, I received an email announcement of a YouTube video of a meeting between Mrzenich and the Dalai Lama. I haven't had a chance to look at that yet, though. Maybe 5 or 6 years ago, PBS was conducting a fundraising drive, and they were offering a Posit Science brain training bundle as a reward for a substantial donation, and so I made the donation. I believe Posit Science is now offering their software on a subscription basis, though, streaming the games to your computer through the web browser. One of the things that Clive writes about, though, is that effective brain training games are very demanding, and there's a bit of a disconnect for older folks, in as much as the games demand a lot of energy from people who are experiencing a real decline in energy. So they may have a lot of resistance to the exercise after a certain point and give up. This reminds me of an experience I had maybe 10 or 15 years ago, going to an exercise gym that used an approach that I think was called super slow. The idea was to work out on the various exercise machines with super slow movement, increasing the resistance to the point of muscle failure. Even though my trainer was a pretty girl, urging me to try harder, I built up so much psychological resistance that I stopped going. I found it both physically and psychologically exhausting to reach that point of muscle failure, and not even having a pretty young thing as a cheerleader was able to get me to overcome my resistance to going back to that place. I experienced something similar with the Posit Science brain training exercises. The one that stands out is an exercise designed to help the brain distinguish sounds. They maintain that hearing problems experienced by the elderly are not all related to the ears, but also to the slowdown of brain processing. The exercise involved distinguishing between sets of phonemes like ba and ga, that's B-A and G-A. As you get on with the exercise, they get progressively slower and come at you progressively faster. And it got to the point where I couldn't distinguish between them, and it felt like I was just guessing. It got very frustrating, and at that point, I quit. I probably should have continued, but didn't. Let's see if I can give you a feel for what I was hearing. It starts off with ba, ga, ba, ga, ba, ga, ba, ga, ba, ga, ba, ga, ga, ga. That's what it sounded like to me. So as a result of the interview with Clive, however, I'm freshly inspired to try the exercises related to visual acuity and safer driving. I'll keep you posted on that down the line. Maybe.
Hi, guys. This is Tony from Australia. I've been a monthly donator to Shrink Wrap Radio for a while now. And it feels good. It feels good to support Dr. Dave. And also, it feels good to in some way, you know, financially contribute to this amazing service that he provides for the community out there. But as 2014 finishes and 2015 starts, I sort of reassess or take stock, you know, and it prompts me to think about the things that mean something to me in this life. And this podcast is one of those things that I hold very dear. So on top of my monthly donation, I've decided to give a one-off donation. I celebrate Christmas. To me, this is a Christmas present to Dr. Dave. For you, it can be whatever you want it to be. But I urge you all to dig deep and support Dr. Dave at this time of year. Thanks again, guys. Thanks, Dr. Dave. See ya.
Thank you, Tony, for this heartwarming Christmas gift. I hope others will be inspired to follow your fine example. Do it now, and it will be here in time for Christmas. And Tony and all my other wonderful Australian listeners, I'm saddened, as I know you must be, by the recent terrorist act in Sydney. Even if you don't live in Sydney, I know that you Australian listeners will have felt impacted by this shocking blow, just as all of us in the U.S. were by the 9/11 attack. I hope that Shrink Wrap Radio will be a light in dark times. On a cheerier note, let me take a moment to announce recent additions to our donor honor roll. My thanks go out to Cynthia Pereira Lira, Alexander Stowe Graylin Frey, Mary Stock, John Bruce, Patricia Preston, Margareta Scheipner, Deborah Swain, Tony Johansson, and Sarah Loftus. And here's some other good news. We are now offering a 10% discount on all of our continuing education courses offered through the Zur Institute. You'll find the complete list of courses under the Store tab on the Shrink Wrap Radio website, as well as at the bottom of each individual interview. We have more than 100 CE units of coursework through the Zur Institute, where you can earn your CE units just for listening to selected Shrink Wrap interviews and answering some simple true-false questions. And I have two more courses on the way that I will be able to announce pretty soon. Now, to get your 10% off, just use the discount code of DrDave88. And that's spelled DrDave and the numerals 88. No spaces in between the name and the numerals. And speaking of discounts, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is also offering a discount on a course on alchemy with Jungian analysts Robbie Bosnack and Patricia Berry, both of whom I've interviewed in the past. The 10 sessions of this course are spread out over 2 years. You can attend the 10 live webinar sessions and will also receive an audio recording of each session. You'll find dates and other details on our Shrink Wrap Radio website under the Partners tab. The cost of the course is $150 US, but you can receive 15% off by using the discount code Dr. Dave, and that's just DrDave. And speaking of strategic partners, we've entered into a mutual support agreement with the Asheville Jung Center. They offer webinars with major Jungian analysts, and they also own Chiron Publishing, which is devoted to publishing books by Jungian authors. We may have special offers from this new partner down the line. Finally, let me remind you of our affiliate relationship with Audible.com, where, if you're not already a member, You can get a free book of your choice from their more than 165,000 titles. I'm a huge fan of Audible because for many years, I've always had an Audible book going to listen to in my car or on walks. My current recommendation is the book Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. It's a runaway bestseller and very soon will come out as a major Hollywood movie directed by Angela Jolie. The book's author is Laura Hillenbrand, who also wrote the very popular Seabiscuit. You can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Matthew, who is home for the holidays from Manhattan. What a joy to have the family all together again. Believe it or not, there are no new listener emails to share. So, I think with that, we'll wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Also, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to journalist Clive Thompson for sharing his research on the potential of video games to fend off the mental decline associated with aging. Do you ever or have you ever struggled with envy? Come on, be honest. Well, my next guest will be San Francisco therapist Dr. Josh Gressel, and we'll be discussing his 2014 book, Embracing Envy in Life and Therapeutic Practice. So, until next time, this is Dr. Dave wishing you and yours happy holidays and reminding you that it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.